Hello and welcome to the Risk Map Podcast, part of the global conversation on geopolitics and security, produced by Control Risks, the leading international risk consultancy. I'm Charles Hecker in London.
Also in London, I'm Huma Yusuf, Associate Director for the Middle East and North Africa. Welcome to the podcast.
This week's podcast is going to take us to South Korea, where presidential elections have resolved some of the issues in Korea's political past, but have opened up a new series of issues for the immediate future. Companies doing business in South Korea will need to take note.
We'll then go to Iran, which is holding its own elections on the 19th. There we forecast incumbent President Hassan Rouhani will return to office.
And finally, we'll hover off the southern coast of Italy, where the G7 will meet at the end of the month. What should we expect from a meeting that will have more than one new participant?
But first, South Korea. Chuck spoke earlier with Julia Koim in our Shanghai office.
Julia is our senior analyst for Northeast Asia. Julia, this week Moon Jae-in was sworn in as the 19th president of South Korea. Was his victory expected in the elections?
Absolutely, Chuck. Moon led the opinion polls for months ahead of the elections, and he won with a very comfortable double-digit margin over the runner-up candidate from the main conservative party.
So why such a resounding victory?
Moon really benefited from the influence peddling scandal around former President Park Geun-hye, who was impeached in March. In fact, her impeachment led to early elections, which were originally scheduled for December. And as the leading candidate from the main opposition Democratic Party, Moon was able to really capitalize on the severe disillusionment among voters with Park's administration.
Okay, so that covers the background. Now let's look forward a little bit and the business community. Is the business community going to be, and forgive me for this, over the moon about the new president?
They are probably not going to be very excited. Moon is planning significant policy shifts from the Park administration that will probably raise operating costs for companies in South Korea. While Park advocated liberalizing labor market hiring and firing practices, which is something businesses have long called for, Moon has promised a different kind of labor reform, basically increasing benefits for contract workers, making sure they have the same protections and rights as permanent full-time employees. Moon has proposed limiting working hours and raising the minimum wage by more than 50% in the next 3 years. He's also promised to create over 800,000 jobs, primarily in the public sector.
Okay, just one quick clarifying point on that, Julia. This will apply equally to Korean companies and to international companies with a Korean presence. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. And so how is Moon going to pay for this ambitious problem? How is he going to cover the cost of raising the minimum wage and limiting working hours? What's in his financial plans?
Probably he'll do that by raising individual and corporate taxes.
So what's that going to mean, do you think, for South Korea's conglomerates, these sort of much-discussed chaebols?
Right. The Chaebol were at the center of Park's influence peddling scandal, with allegations that Park solicited bribes worth millions of dollars from South Korea's largest companies in exchange for business favors. Both Park and the de facto chair of Samsung are currently in jail and being tried over those very allegations. Moon, therefore, campaigned on a platform to radically reform the cozy ties between big business and politics, partly by reforming the murky cross-shareholding structures through which the Chaebol families control their corporate empires. But also, Moon plans to strengthen anti-corruption and anti-competition enforcement. It's important to note that this will not just affect Chaebol, but also multinationals doing business in South Korea. Scrutiny of compliance violations will definitely increase, and companies should be paying more attention to this area.
That's a really, really important point. Thank you very much for that. That's the domestic scene. Let's switch for a second to foreign policy. I mean, the Korean Peninsula right now is the center of global attention. What can we expect from the Moon administration on foreign policy, and are we going to see a big change in that respect as well?
Yes, definitely. The most notable change is that Moon wants an engagement-based approach to North Korea, which is radically different from the previous conservative government's hardline approach towards Pyongyang. Moon is willing to offer the North financial incentives to return to the negotiating table and is willing to reopen the Kaesong Joint Industrial Complex, which was closed in early 2016 and is an important source of revenue for the North.
So this has the potential of putting Moon at odds with U.S. President Donald Trump. How is this going to affect relations between the United States and South Korea?
Moon's election certainly makes the bilateral relationship more complicated. If the U.S. continues on a hardline approach and Seoul does not, it'll be a source of tension. However, President Trump has also suggested that he would be willing to meet with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. So at the same time, we have this awkward situation where escalated tensions also see renewed multilateral engagement more possible than in recent years, reflecting just generally much greater uncertainty on the Korean Peninsula. That said, we don't expect a genuine improvement regarding the North Korea situation, and denuclearization remains highly unlikely. We expect the North will concurrently try to obtain financial concessions from Seoul for coming back to the negotiating table, while also continuing regular missile and even nuclear tests, probably until it feels confident it can send a nuclear-armed intercontinental ballistic missile all the way to the continental United States. And this is probably going to restrict Moon's ability to fully implement his engagement-based North Korea policy. But U.S.-South Korea ties could also strain over other issues. Just days before the election, Trump insisted that South Korea carry more of the financial burden for the deployment of the U.S. Terminal High Altitude Area Defense, or THAAD, anti-missile system in South Korea. Moon initially strongly opposed the deployment, largely because China protested the deployment through economic retaliation against South Korean companies, but then softened that opposition, particularly with increased North Korean missile testing in the weeks before the election. But if Trump presses for cost renegotiation on THAAD or renegotiation of the U.S.-South Korea Bilateral Free Trade Treaty, as he has said he will, he will find that Moon is much less willing to compromise than the past administration would have been.
Wow, Julia, this sounds like an incredibly mixed picture, both for domestic politics and for foreign affairs in the region. And I think also importantly, a tougher operating environment for companies. Julia Kleiman, Shanghai, thank you very, very much.
Thanks, Chuck.
Iran's elections never looked like they would be a simple affair. The country remains the focus of acute international attention as it maintains compliance with the accords limiting its nuclear power program. It remains engrossed in conflict in the Middle East and is trying to feel its way through the early days of the Trump administration. Huma spoke with our lead Iran consultant, Henry Smith.
Henry, tell me a little bit about why Control Risks is forecasting a win for the incumbent President Hassan Rouhani.
Control Risks is expecting Hassan Rouhani to win a second term as president for a few reasons. The available opinion polls and also his performance in the free presidential debates that have been held over the past 3 weeks indicate that he is likely to win a greater share of the vote than any other candidate. Similarly, the withdrawal of one of the more hardline candidates, Mohammed Kalabaf, is also likely to send some more votes his way, as not all those votes were likely simply to be transferred to the other hardline candidate, Ibrahim Raisi. You have also seen some quite extensive coverage of events that Rouhani has held throughout the country, where he clearly has the support of reformist-minded voters who have chanted the names of former presidents and former presidential candidates but are now under house arrest or barred from speaking publicly in Iran. These candidates have also used various social media channels to endorse Rouhani in the past few days.
Would a somewhat decisive win for Rouhani impact the way in which Iran is complying with the JCPOA, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal that was finalized last year?
I think a lot of the attention in the English language media on Iran's election has perhaps mistakenly focused on the nuclear deal as being a crucial election issue. It is a crucial election issue in the sense that its economic benefits have not been as widely felt as voters or indeed political leaders expected it to be. And that has clearly been a relevant and topical issue. However, none of the candidates have campaigned on a position of wishing to undermine or cancel the nuclear deal. You still see fairly broad consensus across the Iranian political establishment that the nuclear deal is necessary for Iran's economic security and also its national security, in that it staved off what looked like the increasing probability of US and or Israeli military action.
So if the nuclear deal is not the issue at stake for the Iranian public in this particular election, then what issues are?
The economy is a major electoral issue. The incumbent President Rouhani has managed to do a good job of stabilizing what was a very poor and fragile economic situation. Inflation has dropped, GDP has grown, exports has grown. But that has mainly been a story of Iran's oil production and exports being able to access international markets once again because of a nuclear deal. What you haven't seen happen is disposable incomes grow significantly, employment prospects increase greatly, and those are the issues that Rouhani's opponents are really trying to tackle him on. When we think about what the political risk for businesses is in the Iranian election results, a Rouhani victory is likely to see broad continuity in policy towards foreign investment, so being broadly pro it happening, albeit with certain restrictions in certain sectors of Iran's economy and a great emphasis on local content. If you saw a Raisi victory, which is a hardline opponent to Rouhani, you would probably see much the same, but a greater emphasis on indigenous capability building, local content, requirement on employing local nationals and using local companies, which sit very neatly with the Supreme Leader's message of building the resistance economy.
Thank you, Henry. We'll have to see what happens on the 19th of May and see what Rouhani comes up with if he wins that second term.
Thank you, Huma.
The G7 meets regularly, and usually it's a collection of fairly familiar faces. But the upcoming gathering in Sicily will include not only G7 newbie Donald Trump, but also freshly elected French President Emmanuel Macron. Chuck spoke with senior analyst David Lee for a view on what to expect from the meeting in the Mediterranean.
Dave, I wanted to talk about two things. First of all, we have a lot of newcomers at the G7. We've got newbies President Donald Trump and President Emmanuel Macron from Paris. But we also had the finance ministers meeting, which serves as a bit of a warm-up for the main event. Give us your view on what happened with the finance ministers meeting, and then what do you think is going to happen when the presidents and the prime ministers all get together?
Yeah, it's always a tantalizing little glimpse for geopolitics watchers a couple of weeks before the G7 summit when the finance ministers get together and talk about the financial side of the issues of the day. The big story this time, obviously, was trade and the likely impact of the Trump administration's policies on trade, which are, as we know, pretty different from the kind of thing we've generally seen over the last couple of decades.
Well, although he's walking back a little bit on some of the anti-globalization extremism, is that right?
Yeah, absolutely. And his Treasury Secretary, Mnuchin, was there over the weekend and came out of it saying that he felt that the people in the room were warming towards him, but there was still some way to go for them to warm towards the administration's policies totally, but he felt they were on the road, which is, you know, a positive view on things, at least.
So are they a fairly friendly bunch, the G7 finance ministers? I mean, do they welcome this total outsider into their midst?
Friendly bunch wouldn't be the first term I'd use, frankly. But it is, you know, it's a reflection of the reality that they're going to have to get used to a Trump administration for 4 years. They've got a lot of work to do with that administration in the future. So, of course, they're going to get on well. Bears mentioning, though, that the Italian host of the meeting was so pessimistic about getting anything done on trade, they nearly took it off the agenda entirely, which would have spoken volumes, I think.
What's left to talk about if you take trade off the agenda at a G7 meeting?
Well, in the finance minister's meeting, there was actually quite a bit. They discussed the foreign exchange and how to avoid a repeat of the currency wars we saw a couple of years ago. The cybersecurity was already on the agenda, and obviously after Friday's news, that went even higher up. So there was quite a bit on the table still.
Okay, so that's the warm-up. Now we've got everybody gathering in Sicily at the end of the month. So how is that going to go?
Yeah, I think the interesting thing there is obviously the new people around the table, as you said. Donald Trump's obviously going to be there. And how he gets on in a room with six other people rather than just one. He's had a couple of bilateral meetings so far, most notably Angela Merkel, but how he gets on with the slightly more regimented atmosphere of the G7 will be an interesting one. Obviously, Macron will be there as well. It'll be his first big international engagement, and there'll be people saying, oh, he'll look to make his mark. I think he's probably going to settle for making his mark over a period of time rather than trying to hit a home run in his first at bat.
Is there anything specific that we want to see happen that we should be looking for? Is there anything that the business world needs to be alerted to about the outcome of this G7 meeting, or frankly, any G7 meeting?
Yeah, that's a fair point. I think we're back on the trade subject again, because I think that is really significant at the moment. Whether the US edge towards policies that could be seen as protectionist does continue, whether anyone can find accommodation with that, with the rest of the G7, whether the Trump administration can convince particularly the European members that America first doesn't have to mean everybody else last. So I think they're the most interesting issues coming out of it.
Lastly, Dave, Angela Merkel is going to this looking super strong.
Yeah.
She's just had her CDU party win big in North Rhine-Westphalia, which is Germany's most populous state. She's got quite a head of steam going on the way into German elections. Is she going to be running this meeting?
I think she'll be quite refreshed in that she probably doesn't have to run this meeting, because Germany's had to take a lead that it hasn't really wanted to in so much world affairs, and particularly European affairs, in the last few years. But she is looking very strong. The CDU winning in North Rhine-Westphalia is pretty close to the Republicans winning in California or the Conservatives winning in Liverpool. So it's a pretty strong position she's in domestically and on the European level as well.
Great, Dave. Thank you very much for this preview of the G7. We'll probably be back to talk again once the meeting is over. David Lee, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chuck, thanks. Before we sign off, here are a few other issues we're watching closely in the coming weeks.
On Wednesday, the 24th of May, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, will hold its summit in Brussels. U.S. President Donald Trump has committed to attending that meeting, despite his frequent criticism of the alliance.
The following day, Thursday, 25th May, OPEC will meet in Vienna to decide on production policy for the second half of 2017. Most analysts expect the group of oil-exporting nations to extend their output cuts amid the continued glut in prices.
Saturday, the 27th of May, marks the founding of the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or the FARC, which signed a historic peace accord with the Colombian government last November. Though the ceasefire remains in place, the peace process will continue to be long and complicated. For a full view of the risks and rewards for the private sector in Colombia, see our report, The Peace Dividend, at controlrisks.com.
That's it for the Risk Map podcast for the second half of May 2017. Find us every 2 weeks on Podbean, the Control Risk website, and iTunes. Thanks for listening. I'm Huma Yusuf in London.
Huma, thanks for co-hosting, and thanks to everyone who clicked and listened. From London, I'm Charles Hecker. We'll talk again in another couple of weeks.